This week's guest on Words on a Wire is J.L. Powers, though I must confess I have a difficult time calling her J.L. since she's a former student and I knew her as Jessie. So I'll just continue my introduction with that disclaimer. J.L. Powers explores social issues involving violence, sexuality, and race in her books for young adults. She is the author of The Confessional, a novel for young adults that explores racial tension and violence on the U.S.-Mexico border. In a starred review, Publishers Weekly said, Powers' first novel powerfully combines timely storylines regarding illegal immigration, school violence, and racial tension. While the Bulletin of the Center for Children's Books declared that Powers confronts issues of anti-immigrant prejudice and anti-terrorist hysteria with brutal honesty, describing a world not often depicted in literature for young people. Jessie, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I want to ask you one question to begin with. You were in our MFA program how many years ago here at the University of Texas at El Paso?
Oh, it's embarrassing to admit how many years ago, but I graduated in 1999.
And your thesis was as a poet, is that correct?
It was partly with poetry and partly short stories, so I did half and half.
And then after you got your MFA, you decided to go into the intellectual field, and you went to Stanford to be an Africanist, is that correct?
That's correct.
And what drew you to being an Africanist?
Well, the last summer that I was at UTEP, I took a class in the summer. Well, I was teaching in the summer, and when you're a graduate student, at least back then, if you were teaching a class, you had to take a class. So I saw that they were offering an African history class, and I took it. And I was so intellectually stimulated by the process. And I think, you know, I was 24 when I took that class, and I realized I was going to be graduating in a year, and I felt like I had gained a lot of skills in terms of writing, but I had no knowledge about anything. I felt really clueless about the world, and I thought, I don't have anything to write about. I haven't experienced a whole lot. So I was so intellectually stimulated by it, I felt very challenged by the subject matter, that I thought, you know, I need to spend some time learning about something, not just learning the skill of writing, but learning about something. But beyond that, you know, I think growing up in El Paso, I grew up, you know, I'm not Latino or Latina, but I grew up in El Paso, and I just have always felt very drawn to other cultures as a result, growing up essentially as a minority, which is very unusual for, a white girl. To grow up as a minority in the United States, but I did, and I think I was really drawn to, you know, the states in Africa that had been settled by colonizers, and I was drawn to the racial tensions and the cross-cultural implications of, you know, Europeans migrating there, and these subjects, I think, were very much things I wanted to explore because of growing up in El Paso. And so there were just really a myriad of reasons why I ended up studying African history. But I think the first and most important one was that I felt like I didn't know anything about the world.
Well, which is interesting because being an Africanist led you to eventually write this novel called This Thing Called the Future.
Yes.
And did you actually visit South Africa?
Oh, yes. You know, I took intensive Zulu for 3 years, and 10 weeks of that intensive Zulu was in South Africa, during which time I lived with a Zulu family in a township called Mbali, which is the township that's in my book. And I was taking, you know, 5 hours of Zulu every day and then living with a Zulu family. And then I returned. I became fascinated with the concept of healing in South Africa, or actually in Africa. You know, Africans are obsessed with healing. And I don't know if that's, I think that's partly because there's more disease in Africa than there is in many other parts of the world. I mean, you know, mankind evolved there. and so did the diseases that come along with mankind. And so there's all of these diseases, and Africans are obsessed with healing. And also in South Africa in particular, because of the apartheid state and the wounds that have been left on society because of the terrible racism and legalized racism that was enshrined through apartheid and glorified in the religion, the Christian religion that was taught there in the Reformed Church, people are also obsessed with this idea of healing social wounds. And so these all come together in this glorious smattering of healers everywhere you look. Like, you can't walk down a city street, literally, in South Africa without tripping over a healer of some type. And people stand on street corners and they hand out these pamphlets to you that promise, you know, if you go to this, you know, Mama Abu or whatever, who's just around the corner, you can be healed from these things. And I saw, so here I was immersed in this society, learning Zulu, living with a Zulu family, and really, really interested in this question of healing, and that led to this novel. And I might add that, you know, at the time that I was there, HIV was the height of the epidemic, was, you know, reaching its apex in, you know, 2006, 2007, and 2008. And so I, you know, and every time I returned to do more research for the book, you know, I was also focusing on this question of how HIV was devastating the communities and how people were responding to that.
And was it heartbreaking for you to write this novel?
It was. You know, I had three Zulu sisters in the family that I lived in. They were 6 years old, 13 and 14. And, you know, the 13 and 14-year-old used to come to my bedroom at night, every night, and sit on my bed. It was very cold in that house, so I'd be huddled under blankets with a hot water bottle. People don't think of Africa as being cold, but it was really cold. And they would sit there and they would tell me their secrets about their lives. And one night, the 13-year-old told me that she wasn't allowed to go to church anymore by herself. And I said, why not? And she said, because Gogo, the grandmother, caught me kissing my boyfriend. I was like, oh, you have a boyfriend. And I thought she was going to tell me this sweet little story about, you know, a fellow 13-year-old in her class. But it turned out that her boyfriend was a taxi driver in the townships. He was in his 30s. And I just sat back in shock and tried to figure out, how do I respond to this in this exact moment, and realizing that my 13-year-old sister is clearly at risk for getting HIV. And so it was a very direct and very personal story. The statistics are heartbreaking, but, you know, I had actual people that I loved that were at risk.
Let me ask you a question. Did you kind of think a lot about how a white woman is writing about a young girl named, is it Kosi? Is that how you say Kosi?
Mm-hmm. Kosi.
Who is a Zulu in South Africa. Did you feel like maybe you were colonizing an experience, or what did that feel like?
Boy, I sure did. You know, it was something that I never expected to do, and that was one of the reasons why I went into academics, right? I was interested in African history, but I felt okay if I was writing about it in this very sterile, dry academic language that historians use. And also, I might add that, you know, within the academy, of course, there's sort of this horrifying thought of, you know, white people writing about Africans in that way. There's a long history of Europeans doing just that and, you know, revealing all sorts of racist stereotypes, et cetera. And I felt very nervous about it. It wasn't something I ever set out to do intentionally. And, in fact, I was working on an entirely different novel about, you know, a kid growing up in the San Francisco Bay Area and, you know, becoming homeless during the vast majority of the times that I was visiting South Africa, that on that and on my return trip. And I thought I would write a nonfiction book about this obsession with healing that Africans have and that I have, you know, I think. And then, you know, slowly I started, you know, realizing that I wanted to write this novel, and I had to come to terms with it, and I had to do a number of things. Number one, I had to very carefully research everything. I had to have lots of people read it. And I had to sit back and say to myself, if I don't write this novel and put it onto the American market, who is going to?
Right.
And that's ultimately what gave me the ability to say, I am not going to write it perfectly, and I may not be the best person to write it. But right now, I'm the only person who is going to do it.
And how difficult was it to get into your character, Cosey's, head?
You know, the novel took me close to 3 years to write, and I think it's because it was difficult to get into her head. The first few drafts were, you know, very brief, and I had planned, oh, I'm just going to write, it's going to be like an 80-page novel, you know, with really short chapters. And really short chapters because that felt safer to me. Like, you know, you can get in and get out, and you can't make too many mistakes if you just get in or into her head and get out. Pull out really quick. And as it evolved, that could no longer be the, you know, it couldn't be a safe novel anymore. And no, and writers can't write safe novels. If we write safe novels, then what are we doing?
That's exactly right.
We're talking to J.L. Powers, author of This Thing Called the Future and a new novel called Amina, which also takes place in Africa. I wanted to ask you a question about, you said you studied Zulu for 5 hours a day. That is quite a commitment. And I imagine it must have given you some sort of linguistic insight into the culture that you would not have had hadn't you been so committed. Can you give us some examples of that?
Well, you know, there are, of course, all sorts of sayings in Zulu that, you know, are partly a result of the evolution of the culture that are very hard, actually, to understand until you've been studying the language for a long time. There's funny ones, like, you know, it's so hot, the fish are hopping out of the water. and then there's these ones that, you know, you wonder, what does this mean? And, like, for example, no spirit fails to go home. What does that mean? And what does that means something really different to me.
Right.
Can you say that in Zulu?
Not at the moment.
Sorry, I hate to put you on the spot. Okay.
Jessica, let me ask you something. Since you know a little bit of Zulu, do you ever look around town for a Zulu restaurant so you can impress people and order in the actual language?
There is no such thing as a Zulu restaurant anywhere in the United States.
Oh, that's
States.
Well, all right. Let me ask you another question. I'm going to back off from all the seriousness. When you were a student here at UTEP, I always called you Jessie, and most people mm-hmm. called you Jessica. So why did you choose your nom de plume to be J.L. Powers?
Well, you know, my first novel was The Confessional. It was set in El Paso, and it was about young men. All the protagonists were young men, and they were...
Who went to Cathedral High School?
Yes, although I named it Jesuit High.
Right.
You know, I was being political, but... when my editor, I was just planning to be, you know, Jessica Powers, but my editor approached me and said, you know, we want young men to buy this novel, and we don't think they'll buy it if you write with Jessica.
Oh, that's interesting.
So they called you J.L. Powers.
Yes, so they suggested that I find a different choice.
Well, it is a very strong name, J.L. Powers.
And you were comfortable with that? Like, it's okay?
Well, you know, I was probably more comfortable with it than if the idea had come out of nowhere. But, you know, I grew up reading these 19th century authors who all had initials for their first names or, you know, or wrote under initials.
Right.
And, you know, one of my all-time favorite children's authors is L.M. Montgomery, who wrote the Anne of Green Gables series. And so as a kid, knowing I wanted to be a writer when I grew up, and I loved L.M. Montgomery, I used to kind of play around with this. Should I be J.L. Powers? And so it was less of a shock than it might have been for other people. But you know what is weird is when people call me J.L., because I certainly don't think of myself as J.L.
I certainly don't think of you that way.
It makes you sound like an executive, J.L.
So did you get any flack for writing this book as a white woman, writing about a Zulu adolescent?
Well, the answer is yes and no. So I should say that I got some flack for my first book, too, because I wrote from boys' perspective.
Right.
and maybe less slack than I would have otherwise, because I grew up in El Paso. There, you know, there are some Latino characters in there as well. But, you know, I did it with my first book, too. And so I'd already sort of steeled myself to the inevitable possibility of people questioning me about it. You know, most people have really embraced the book. It certainly, you know, won a lot of awards. I did have one friend from Zimbabwe who, you know, wasn't sure. We talked about it a long time. She speaks Ndebele, which is very close to Zulu, and so she had been one of my practice partners for a long time at Stanford. And we talked about it a lot, and, you know, she came away deciding that it was okay, and she read a novel written by a black Zimbabwean that she read, and she was like, man, that is not the Zimbabwe I know at all. And so she said, maybe it's not a perspective of who writes the book so much all the time. I did have one incident where a couple of African-American authors were sort of visibly rude to me on a panel. And, you know, later some audience members, it filtered back to me that they had noticed that it was, you know, that it was visible. And I knew, you know, one of those authors is very sort of adamant that whites shouldn't write about black characters. So I have had some flack. But ultimately, you know, I feel like if we can't write about, am I only allowed to write about white girls who grow up in a Latino community? Because that's my experience.
Right.
Is that all I'm allowed to write? You know, I would have loved to say to one of these African-American authors who write about, one of them writes about some, you know, disabled characters, and she's not disabled. Well, I spent several years with debilitating pain, went to the Mayo Clinic. I was disabled for a couple of years. I know what it's like. And, you know, I wonder, you know, she's also writing about people that are different from herself. We all do it.
Exactly.
The question is, where do you draw the line? And everybody has different opinions about that.
Right. You have a webpage. It's jlpowers.net. And one of the things it talks about is your new book, Amina. I guess I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that right, which is also set in Africa. And it's available, it says, in Australia and Great Britain. Is it available in the U.S. too?
Not yet. So I was approached by this publisher in Australia, Alan and Unwin, and they were doing a series on children in conflict zones. And they asked me to write a story about a boy or a girl.
But is it going to be available? Because it sounds fascinating.
Thank you. I hope so. They are, I think, in the process of trying to sell North American rights so that the whole series can end up in the United States. And I'm crossing my fingers because, you know, I feel very stymied. You know, it's hard to say much about it at all because then people are like, where can I get it?
And right.
I have to say, you can't. Unless you want to fly to Australia.
And I urge our readers to go to your webpage and look at the book trailer that you have on Amina. It's really well done. Who did that?
They did.
Wow, they must really like your stuff.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I worked with them on it. You know, at first the music was very somber, and it needs to be somber music. I mean, it's about a girl who is growing up on the streets of Mogadishu, Somalia, which has been war-ridden since the early 90s, and she's a street artist. She, you know, is a graffiti artist, a poet who writes her poems on the walls of the city and uses the rubble of the city to create her art.
Sounds like a Chicano.
Yeah.
Exactly. Let me change the subject for just one second, because you're not only an author, you're also an editor, and you edited through Cinco Puntos Press That Mad Game, Growing Up in a War Zone, an anthology of essays from around the globe. Can you talk a little bit about that experience and how you came up with that idea?
Yeah, well, Bobby Bird at Cinco Puntos one time asked me to read a book set, it was a novel set in Ireland during some of the Troubles, and they were thinking about publishing it. And so I read it, and not entirely sure who had the idea first, but either Bobby or I made the comment, this was many years ago, you know, there should be an anthology about this. And I kept returning to the idea because violence is one of the core things that I explore in all of my novels. In The Confessional, there is a murder, a kidnapping, a race riot. In This Thing Called the Future, my main character, Kosi, is stalked by a man with shape-shifting powers who wants to rape her. And, it, you know, this is one of the most common things in South Africa. Young women's first sexual experiences is often very violent, and through rape, 1 in 4 men in South Africa have admitted to raping a young woman. And in Amina as well, of course, you know, I'm investigating the violence that she endures as a young woman growing up in a war-torn city. Violence is something that I am obsessed about, too, along with healing. You know, the two are probably related.
Right, they are, right? After violence, you need healing.
Probably in quotation marks.
And what about what about the Mexican healers, the curanderas? Do you have much experience with them, having grown up in El Paso? And is there a connection between the fascination of the African healers?
There is a real connection. You know, I don't have a lot of experience with the curanderas, but I grew up, you know, hearing stories from, you know, some of my friends. Their mothers would talk about either themselves or their grandmothers visiting curanderas in Mexico. And I always was really interested in these cross-cultural contexts where, you know, some people would cross the U.S.-Mexico border to go visit a dentist or a doctor on that side, or vice versa. And what were the reasons and why some people would visit curanderas, and this mixture of medical practices, and how, you know, why people would access a curandera in one case and a medical doctor in another case, and maybe even go visit a faith healer in another case. And so I find this, you know, the reasons fascinating. And so, yeah, I grew up with it, and it just transferred.
How can such a happy, upbeat person write about such, like horrifying, violent, almost depressing subject matters?
I don't know. My mother-in-law asks me that sometimes. She says, why don't you write nice things? Like, I seem to be incapable of it. But, you know, I guess I want to plumb the depths of human experience, and that includes looking at the dark side of the human experience. And you can't really look at healing if you don't look at the dark side.
You know, you live in Livermore, California. I got to say, I grew up in Livermore, California. I went through my adolescence. I even went through my puberty in Livermore, California. So it is a very meaningful city to me. How's it?
I know. I'm in your stomping ground.
Yeah.
You're in mine.
What's it like there? Has it grown? They used to have this no growth policy where they wouldn't let any developments come in.
Huh. Well, you know, I don't have a whole lot to compare it to. I've only been here for 4 years,
but there are
housing developments going up. And
do the Della Rosa still live right there on Olive Avenue?
Probably.
Well, thank you so much, Jessica, for joining us. We're talking to J.L. Powers, author of This Thing Called the Future and editor of That Mad Game. Check out her webpage. She has a lot of other books that are just incredibly powerful. So thank you for joining us.
Jesse, thank you for being on Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much.